From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Asma Khalid. This is Radio Boston.
So I'm hoping today's announcement gives women confidence that contraceptive coverage will be protected here in Massachusetts.
This hour, Governor Charlie Baker is scheduled to sign into law the Access Bill, which will ensure access to birth control for women in Massachusetts. And the GOP tax plan would increase taxes for graduate students. An MIT student says this would bankrupt her. Plus, author and activist Jacqueline Friedman on the unfulfilled promises of the sexual revolution and what real sexual equality means. And the senior food editor of Yankee Magazine shares some of her favorite local New England foods. And they might not be what you'd expect, chocolate and creme brulee. That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston, and I'm Asma Khalid. This hour at the Massachusetts State House, Governor Charlie Baker is scheduled to sign into law the so-called Access Bill. Access because it ensures that Massachusetts women will continue to have the access to free birth control that they gained under the Obama administration and the Affordable Care Act. To tell us more, we're joined, as we are most Mondays, by Carrie Goldberg, host of WBUR's Common Health. Hey, Carrie.
Hey,
thank you for coming in.
Sure.
So what exactly is new in this law?
Well, so I'd sum up this law as saying very generally to Massachusetts women, don't worry. You know, no matter what happens in Washington, here in Massachusetts, we'll be doing our best to keep your birth control covered and free with no copays. And in fact, the law even is going to expand your coverage a little bit. So basically what it does is it encodes into state law, the Obama era, so federal mandates for free birth control, meaning in most cases, it has to be covered. It has to be copay free. And you might remember that after President Trump was elected, a lot of younger women were saying, quick, get your IUD now, right? Because it might not stay covered under a Trump administration. Well, for many women in Massachusetts now, this law is trying to give them more confidence that they don't need to rush to get that IUD, that their birth control coverage has just gotten some more legal protection.
Got it. Okay. So, Carrie, it seems like this is really particularly timely because I do recall last month, President Trump rolled back the Obama-era rule that employers had to cover birth control through their insurance plans. And it seems like there was essentially a religious or a moral objection that a company had. They could exempt themselves out from this. And, of course, you know, the question is what constitutes a moral objection that doesn't seem to really be clearly defined.
Right.
So to clearly understand what you're saying, it seems like this new rule here in Massachusetts that it essentially protects women and would even protect them if their employer does essentially opt out of covering birth control.
Right, for many employers. And so now, after that Trump rule last month, Massachusetts has become the first state to, you know, fire back or respond or counter with a new law. And, you know, this is striking, Asma, not just because it's the first such response, but because this law just sailed so quickly through the legislature in recent days. And the law saying, again, that not only are we cementing into place the Obama-era birth control mandate, but we're going to even expand our birth control coverage a little bit.
Okay, so Carrie, talk to me a little bit about that last part of it. How does it do that? How does it expand coverage?
So, for example, the new law requires insurers in most cases to cover a full year of birth control pills at once. You know, until now, oftentimes women have had to go back to the pharmacy again and again in the course of a year to get their prescriptions. And it also requires coverage of more types of birth control. And it says that emergency contraception, so the so-called morning after pill, has to be covered without a prescription, which makes sense because when you need it fast.
Got it. And this is for all employers in Massachusetts?
No, by no means all. So it's important to note that it's for companies that buy Massachusetts health insurance. So it doesn't apply to companies that insure themselves. So that's many big institutions and even some cities and towns. They fall under federal law instead. So it doesn't technically apply to them, but they do tend to follow state norms on coverage. And so the backers of this law say they're hoping the self-insured companies will adopt what the law does. does as well.
Got it. And when will these new rules go into effect?
So the law comes into effect right away when Governor Baker signs it this afternoon, probably in a few minutes. But insurers have 6 months to get these changes into place.
All right. So given that the Trump administration only issued its new birth control rule last month, I mean, you mentioned this as well, Carrie. This seems extraordinarily fast given the sort of usual pace of Massachusetts legislative action.
Yes, it is lightning fast by legislative standards. And it's pretty amazing that this was close to unanimous. Mm-hmm. It was unanimous in the Senate and close in the House. Here's Ilana Margolis from Blue Cross Blue Shield of Massachusetts.
All the stars were aligned to make this happen. It was the right time and the right thing to do.
And she says this law is sending a message to Washington and to other states.
We're setting an example. We're showing how differing thoughts and opinions can come together and find common goals. And we're saying that we're willing to move first, fast, and frankly, furiously to get it done.
And Asma, when was the last time you heard a health insurer say they were going to move furiously, right?
So, Carrie, you know, she mentioned that there were differing thoughts and opinions, but it seems like support for this bill was essentially unanimous. So what's she referring to there?
Right. So the support could be so unanimous because there'd been a lot of work done in advance. There was a whole lot of negotiating between the coalition that backed the bill, which included Planned Parenthood and NARAL Pro-Choice Massachusetts, the ACLU, and the state's powerful health insurers. So it was their ability, these two groups' ability to reach compromises and then come out jointly supporting the bill that cleared the way for it to sail through.
Got it. And what kinds of compromises are you talking about?
Well, so for example, the insurers were kind of leery of covering 12 months of birth control at once because that can be wasteful if the pill doesn't work out for a woman, right? So they reached a compromise that at first, if you're trying a new pill, you only get coverage for 3 months to make sure it works for you. Then you can get the 12-month coverage. Or, for example, the birth control advocates really wanted mandated coverage of vasectomies, but they surrendered on that one. And they say they'll come back to it. And most plans do cover vasectomies anyway.
All right. And so all of that got hashed out in advance then.
Right. Because if you don't have a state's powerful health insurers backing a bill that mandates health insurance coverage, you probably won't get very far, right? So one of the bill's big backers, Rebecca Hartholder from NARAL Pro-Choice Massachusetts, says that for her, the biggest takeaway for advocates of birth control here is not to be afraid to work with unlikely partners.
When you enter into negotiations with insurers who understand the public health benefits of birth control, you know, you're able to hammer out a compromise. And there were moments when I didn't think it would happen, but we hung in there and we stayed at the table with them. So, it was really not being afraid to have strange bedfellows when pushing for women's reproductive freedom. And that was a really important lesson for me.
And from the other side, we have Laura Pellegrini, who leads the Mass Association of Health Plans. She says she also had moments when she wasn't sure an agreement could be reached. But she says women here and around the country are feeling under siege these days, is how she puts it. And she says she hopes this new law will help them feel more confident, at least about birth control.
Got it.
And that women can sleep better tonight knowing that they will still have access to these important birth control methods. I also think there's a real opportunity here for, once again, Massachusetts to lead.
And Laura Pellegrini thinks this is the first measure in the country where the Planned Parenthood Coalition and the health insurers came together like this to figure out how to protect free birth control coverage in the face of these federal challenges.
Okay. So, Carrie, am I correct in assuming that a lot of the impetus for this bill came from women?
Well, that would certainly be correct, yes, but by no means only women. So Dr. Jennifer Childs-Roschak, she's the chief of Planned Parenthood in Massachusetts. She says the men in the insurance industry and in politics didn't need much arm twisting because when you talk about access to birth control, everybody has a story to tell.
How they almost missed filling their prescription, or they had to run to the pharmacy at the last minute to pick up their girlfriend's birth control pill, or they had a condom break and needed access to emergency contraception.
So, I'm actually thinking, Asma, given that this bill passed almost unanimously, It might be fair to say that here in Massachusetts, maybe abortion remains controversial, but maybe birth control really isn't anymore.
So there was really nobody against this bill.
So I'm told nobody spoke against it at the hearing that was held for it. The Catholic Action League is actually on record opposing it, but they seem to be the lone voice.
Got it. And so at this point, Carrie, final question for you is, what if a Massachusetts employer has a moral or religious objection to covering birth control? Essentially, I mean, does this law now say that that doesn't matter?
Well, so employers who buy insurance for their workers from Massachusetts insurers can only get an exemption from this new law if they're a church or another religious institution. If they don't qualify for that category, they can't opt out of birth control coverage. But if they try, that could be a matter for the courts.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Carrie.
You're welcome.
Carrie Goldberg is host of WBUR's Common Health Vertical. You can find a link to her post on how Massachusetts passed this bill to ensure free birth control so quickly at our website, radioboston.org. There are about 70,000 graduate students around Boston, and many of them receive tuition waivers in exchange for teaching classes or doing research. These waivers are not considered taxable income, but under the version of the tax plan that the House passed last week, they would be. Erin Russo is a PhD student at the Harvard-MIT program in health sciences and technology. She's studying mental health disorders, and she says the bill would, quote, devastate graduate research in the United States. She wrote an op-ed for the New York Times with the headline, "The House Just Voted to Bankrupt Graduate Students." And she joins me now. Thanks, Erin.
Oh, thank you for having me here.
So, Erin, you know, nationally there are about 145,000 graduate students like yourself who receive these tuition waivers. That's according to the College and University Professional Association for Human Resources. And I'm curious for you, can you explain how this process works? I know some of our listeners may not really be familiar with the idea of a tuition waiver. Specifically, what do you do and what does it mean in terms of your tuition?
Yeah, sure. So it's I want to start off by saying it's very program dependent and it's also very school dependent.
Okay.
So in my case, which is what I can speak to the most, I guess, is that I do research for professors at the institution. So in exchange for our research, we can study there tuition free.
All right. So can you kind of walk me through your finances? How much are you paid a stipend of any sort?
Sure, yeah. So we're paid a stipend. So I'm a pre-qualifier graduate student. So those are graduate students who haven't passed those big exams that let you be a PhD candidate.
Yes.
So because I'm pre-qual, I get paid the master's rate, which is about $33,000 a year.
That's your annual salary.
That's my annual salary before taxes.
Got it. And how much is your tuition worth?
So MIT's tuition is just shy of $50,000 a year.
So that's the price tag.
Yeah, that's the price tag of the tuition.
Got it. And so if this House bill became law, your total income would go to, help me out, $84,000?
So if we're kind of, if we're not adding in all of the different deductions that are under that plan, my taxable income is around $80,000.
Okay, got it. And so have you done the math at all of looking at how your tax bill would increase and
by
how much?
Yeah, it's really, really rough. So even with that $12,000 standard deduction that they're giving us or that they're giving all personal standard deductions,
yes,
I would still go up around $10,000 a year.
Your tax?
My taxes.
Bill. Wow.
Exactly.
Okay. So gosh, that's quite a hefty bill. I just had to take that in for a bit. So can you give me a sense real quick? So how much are you currently paying in taxes?
So we pay, again, it's pretty dependent, but it's around $3,000 to $4,000.
And so you're looking at a tax bill that would be about like $13,000 to $14,000.
Yeah, so it's around a 240% increase.
Okay. You know, Erin, you also wrote in that New York Times piece about a unique medical situation and how that somewhat also complicates your financial situation. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
I can, yeah. So in 2015, so in January of 2015, I was diagnosed with CRPS, which is complex regional pain syndrome. It's also known as reflex sympathetic dystrophy. It's effectively a very, very small orphan disease that causes longstanding chronic pain and like the inability to use a limb.
Oh, wow. Okay. And do you feel that in a particular limb at this point?
Yeah. So that's my right leg.
Oh, wow. Okay. And so does that affect, I mean, your financial situation, I presume, at this
point? Oh, absolutely.
As well?
So the big treatments for that are like biweekly physical therapy, which gets, even with insurance, is very expensive in terms of copays.
So how much of your income do you think goes towards that?
It's around 20%.
20% of your monthly income?
My monthly income, yeah.
Oh, wow. So, you know, Erin, I am sympathetic, right, to what you're describing, but I also you know, I hear the argument, and there is an argument to be had, that you receive these tuition waivers as a condition that you work for the school, mm-hmm. right? You either teach or you do research. And that since you're working for the university, why shouldn't these waivers be considered income for tax purposes, right? That they're a benefit. And what's your take? I mean, how do you respond to that?
I'm sorry. So that they're
that there's
not...
an argument to be had that this is income, right? That you're working for the university and you would otherwise be receiving income, or you would be receiving this benefit in some other financial way, right? It wouldn't be in the
course,
form of a tuition
yeah.
waiver. And so how do you respond to that? Or do you recognize that that is a very real legitimate argument?
Yeah, I mean, of course, it's definitely a legitimate argument. And I guess what I would say to it is that we never see that money, so we don't get the choice as to what we should do with it. So we don't get the choice to either take out a loan to pay for that tuition. It just immediately goes from, like, this nebulous waiver into tuition.
I see. Would you prefer the option to be able to make that decision to take out a loan?
I think in this case, it's much, much easier to have it done in this current structure of just having them waive tuition. But that's, again, for my own personal choice. So I do see the arguments against it.
Got it. So, you know, I spoke, one of our producers here spoke earlier with Preston Cooper. He's a research analyst mm-hmm. for the American Enterprise Institute. He says that the plan will not, as you write in your article, quote, bankrupt graduate students. Here, let's take a listen, actually, to what he had to say.
What I think will happen is that a lot of students who are currently receiving tuition waivers, the universities will just reclassify those waivers as scholarships, which would be untaxed under current law and under the proposal. So I highly doubt that many graduate students will see a major tax hike from this provision.
Erin, I'll let you respond, and then I actually have a follow-up question.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. So I guess my first instinct is that it's actually a really really cool topic to talk about, and tuition reform is something I think this country needs to have a very solid conversation about. What I would say immediately is it isn't what we should be talking about right now, is that that bill seeks to impact graduate students immediately, and assuming that institutions can just immediately change to be able to reclassify tuition structures, I think mm-hmm. is possibly not exactly what they're trying to go for with this bill.
Got it. But the bill does, you know, ensure that scholarships will not be taxed, and it protects that sort of category, right? Mm-hmm. And so you could have the argument that if you were open, or other colleagues of yours were open to the idea of receiving these tuition waivers in the form of scholarships, then in theory, universities would not then just offer tuition waivers. They'd offer scholarships instead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess this really kind of comes down, in my opinion, to institutional elitism. Hmm. So we have these big questions of really big schools with huge endowments can afford to do this quickly. But if you look at my undergraduate institution, which is a SUNY Albany, so okay. University at Albany, it's much harder for public institutions to make these fast changes because they're boards of trustees. Sometimes they even have legislation involved.
In terms of going from a tuition waiver and
exactly.
offering a graduate student
yeah.
scholarship. Okay. Can I ask you a theoretical? I mean, would you accept a scholarship to work or to teach instead of a tuition waiver? I mean, in some ways I'm thinking maybe, you know, some people would say it's better for you. You'd have more flexibility if you wanted to.
Sure. So I guess, unfortunately, in my case, that's not something that's really financially possible for me. So if I knew that I was going to have to take out loans just to go to graduate school where I was already working, I wouldn't have been able to go just because of my medical costs.
But a scholarship.
Yeah, even a so scholarships.
Right? Essentially, if they turned your tuition waiver instead into a scholarship.
I guess it would limit the universities that I would be able to go to those that can have and afford those scholarships.
Got it. All right. You know, you spoke a bit about broadly your concerns about what this law, or potential law, I should say, mm-hmm. would do, and that it would essentially, quote, decimate American competitiveness. Can you explain what you meant by that?
Yeah, of course. So it's really interesting. I'm a member of the Science Policy Initiative at MIT, so we talk a lot about how basic research translates into industrial money and then mm-hmm. therefore kind of drives the American economy. It really comes down to if you limit the amount of graduate students or people who can have a graduate education, you're limiting research, which kind of in turn reduces the amount of output in American innovation.
Got it. And one quick final question for you. You're one graduate student at MIT, mm-hmm. but I've been hearing here and there rumblings. We had a colleague of ours at NPR spent some time with, I think it was one of the graduate student unions there at MIT. What's sort of the vibe on campus? And specifically, I mean, have university administration reached out at all to you all?
Yeah. So our administration has been very supportive, but I think graduate students, especially at MIT and even other institutions, have even helped collaborate to write this original op-ed. So I want to extra thank my colleagues, Sandhya Sumer Subramanian and Jay Patel, who were instrumental in being able to collect information to kind of help get the word out that this matters to graduate students.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Erin.
Thank you.
That's Erin Rousseau. She's a PhD student at the Harvard-MIT program in health sciences and technology, studying mental health disorders. Her op-ed in the New York Times is called "The House Just Voted to Bankrupt Graduate Students." Stay with us. Coming up, did the sexual revolution of the 1960s give women a false sense of empowerment? I'm Asma Khalid. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Asma Khalid. The last couple of months, it's felt like we've been hearing about a constant onslaught of stories from women about sexual harassment, assault, and rape. From accounts against Hollywood producer Harvey Weinstein to journalists like former NPR executive Mike Oreskes to politicians on both sides of the aisle, from Minnesota Senator Al Franken to Alabama Senate candidate Roy Moore. It seems like there is a never-ending blitz, which makes you wonder, is this a moment in which everything is finally going to change? Is this a pivotal moment for sexual culture in America? Jacqueline Friedman has a lot of thoughts about this moment and what cultural shift is needed when it comes to sex. She's a Boston-based writer, activist, and host of the podcast Unscrewed. Her latest book is called Unscrewed: Women, Sex, Power, and How to Stop Letting the System Screw Us All. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you for coming in. So you outline in your book that the sexual revolution of the 1960s is essentially unfinished business, right? That even in some ways it failed because it gave what you describe as faux powerment to women, you know, this false sense of empowerment. So what went wrong?
Well, it was mostly led by and for men is what went wrong, right? And it also got co-opted by the market pretty early, by the Hugh Hefners of the world.
I see.
And so what you read, if you read accounts from the time, is something that a lot of women identify with today, which is women saying, sure, it was no longer taboo to have premarital sex, but now there was a lot of pressure to have sex with any guy who wanted to. And they would say, oh, like, you're hung up if you don't want to have sex with me. So lifting that taboo around premarital sex didn't suddenly equip women with the social standing to stand up for their own boundaries and needs and desires and consider themselves subjects of their own sex lives and not just objects for consumption.
I see. And you wrote that, quote, faux powerment is a quintessentially American trap. It proposes to solve a structural societal problem with an individualistic solution. Just claim your sexuality, ladies. The freaker you get, the freer you'll be, but we can't pretend our way to sexual liberation. A woman saying and doing what she wants is not free if she gets punished for it. And a woman who doesn't feel free enough to know what she wants, a woman who is just saying and doing what she thinks she should want, isn't free either. So explain this to me. I mean, it seems like you're saying that the focus has been wrong, that we've been sort of trying to fix a societal problem by focusing on these individuals.
Yeah. So there's all these folks who want to tell women how to become sexually free. And some say, well, you need to be modest and show that you respect yourself by not expressing your sexuality in public, that sexuality has to inherently be a private expression. And then there are other people who say, I'm empowering myself by posting this naked selfie, right? Or, you know, doing these very explicit public expressions of sexuality. But in reality, what we need to look at are the systems and institutions that keep women from full sexual sovereignty. So I tell the story in the book of a young woman who had body image issues. And a friend of hers said, you should get some boudoir photos taken just for yourself, sexy photos, and you'll maybe be able to see how beautiful you are, right? And so she did it, and she did feel better, and she even felt good enough to share them with her boyfriend. And that is sort of the faux empowerment narrative, right? She's empowered now. But what happened after that is they broke up. He posted them to the internet.
Yeah.
And she was deluged with rape and death threats, and to the point that she was suicidal and didn't want to leave the house. So she's not free just because those photos made her feel good. If we still live in a society that where men feel free to trade women's pictures like playing cards without consent, and also where women if their sexual expressions are public, are punished to the extent that they can't leave their house.
So I get what you're saying, Jacqueline, yeah. and I see the sort of nuance that you're describing. But at the same time, I do think there are many ways that things have gotten better for women, right? I mean, I look around our newsroom and you talk to some of the older women who've been in the business for a long time, and the stories they describe are horrific. And, you know, I look and I can go easily buy birth control, get it anytime I want, however I want. And so it does feel like women have real choices both about their work and their sexuality that feel substantively different than what we saw 50 or 60 years ago.
Oh, no question. No question that things are better now in a lot of ways than they were in 1960. But they are not better enough. And a lot of the ways that they've become better have focused on things that make sex easier and more accessible for men. And women happen to benefit from them. If things were truly better, we wouldn't be hearing every day about a new powerful man who sees women in his employ or sphere of influence professionally as sexual toys.
So, Jacqueline, I've got to ask, I mean, what does real empowerment look like? Because in seeing your book, I felt like there was a lot of criticism about what isn't working. And then you did highlight individual cases. But what does the real empowerment look like in your mind?
Yeah, I like to think of it not as empowerment, but actual power.
Okay,
right?
Okay.
That women have power to run our sex lives the way we want to. We're not meant to keep it private and quiet, right? We don't have to pretend we're not sexual. And we're not punished for it. That we should be equally free to dress modestly if that's what we want to do and not express our sexuality in public, and we're not harassed to smile or look sexier for public consumption, or to be as publicly sexual as we want to be, to access abortion, to be powerful in our careers, you know, and not be punished, not be blamed, shamed, and abused.
I mean, but isn't there something to be said about, it seems like you don't want there to be a value-based judgment, right, made upon these decisions. But for some communities, it seems, I mean, you talk a lot actually in the book about the religious right, that there is this idea of a value judgment really on sex within the culture overall.
I mean, that's fine for the religious right. If you belong to a religious group that says this is what sex is for and what it's not for and that's what you believe, that's fine when it doesn't impinge on my beliefs, right? That my problem is we live in a culture where the definition of what a woman is and can be around sex is determined by the few, mostly white guys, for all of us, right? Like I should also have religious freedom, not just the evangelicals.
Got it. So it seems like what you're describing requires everyone in society to sort of step up here. And it seems sort of utopian, right, to be honest. Like, it's very idealistic. And I hear you. I mean, it feels like, sure, we can hope for the best. But I want to give you, like, a quick analogy, right? Given everything we've heard about what's happened in the context of women, I was having dinner the other night with a friend of mine who's African-American. And she was giving me the analogy of what she tells her young son about how to be safe, right? The conversation she has with him in terms of how he deals with police officers. And she said, look, like, I would love to not have this conversation with him. I would love for him to just be all right and never need to be afraid of the appropriate way to act. But ultimately, she's like, I also want him to survive. And so I'm realistic about the dynamic. And so therefore, I tell him to behave in a certain way. And so it's interesting to me because I do feel like society, we don't, I mean, when I say that in the context of women, I feel like people say like, oh, you're victim blaming. But to some degree, is it just being realistic of the dynamic? And it sounds like what you want is this vision that doesn't exist yet.
Well, but it's not going to exist if we don't make it happen. Culture is Soylent Green. It's made of people. And the culture we have now around sex is not inherent. It's created by all of us. So, sure, if a parent wants to have a conversation with a child about, you know, safety measures, make sure they're grounded in fact. And that's a whole, you know, thing we could go down. There's a lot of myths out there about what really makes us safer and doesn't. But, you know, I imagine that your friend is also supportive of the Black Lives Matter movement, which is trying to make it so future moms don't have to give future speeches to their kids, right? And that's what I'm trying to accomplish with this book. The world does not need more women saying, here's how we need to be careful and small so nobody hurts us. What we need is a vision of a world that could be different in which we don't need to worry about it.
Got it. And as a part of that, do you feel like there are already good examples of how this is being done?
Oh, yeah. I mean, and as you know, in the book, there's a different example in each chapter. Mm-hmm. I spend a lot of time with folks who I think are doing wonderful work improving the sexual culture in any number of ways. And part of that is to say this work looks a lot of different ways. It depends on who you are and what you're interested in. So I spent time with teenagers in Juneau, Alaska, who are teaching their peers about sex ed because their schools don't do an adequate mm-hmm. job of it, and they're doing an amazing job. I spent time with a woman named Cherise Scott, who runs a program in Memphis, Tennessee called Sister Reach, which, among other things, is training clergy to defend reproductive justice using the Bible from a Christian perspective. I spent time up in Maine with a program that's working on helping middle school boys redefine their ideas of masculinity before they get all gelled and hardened. So there's as many different ways to go about making the culture better as there are people. What I hope is that my book will inspire people to get involved in whatever way makes sense to them.
All right. So let's talk a little bit about the moment we're in right now. I mean, you described it even earlier. It seems like it's every day. It really almost is every day. You open up your computer and you're just like, oh, gosh, you too.
Today it's Glenn Thrush.
Yes, that is true. So, you know, do you feel that, I mean, well, actually, let's backtrack a little bit. You talked a little bit about the Anita Hill hearings and how that really opened up your eyes to sexual harassment. And can you describe what it meant to you and why it opened up your eyes?
Yeah. I mean, I had been sexually harassed on the job a couple of years before that. I was a summer job between high school and college, and it was a bankruptcy auction house. So there was a lot of driving around and traveling to like warehouses and things. And the boss who owned the company, you know, just constantly made me feel like a sex object. And everyone around me who tried to help me avoid him. Hmm. Right? Nobody said what he's doing is illegal. Hmm. There's something you can do about it. He doesn't have to be that way. It really was occasionally in the workforce, you will encounter a guy like this, and here's how to sort of try and protect yourself as best as possible. It felt inevitable. And so when I saw Anita Hill a few years later, you stand up in front of the world and say, this is not acceptable. It's not legal. And it's important enough that it should impact whether or not someone gets to have a seat on the Supreme Court. It was transformational for me. I learned the name sexual harassment, which is not language I
had. You had not heard that before.
No. Mm. But it also just opened my eyes to the fact that, like I said, culture is what we make it. You know, that these behaviors are not inevitable, that these are mostly men making terrible choices.
So after the Anita Hill hearings, right, Jacqueline? I mean, I remember that, you know, now when we look back on that moment, there were all of these employment discrimination cases filed in the immediate year afterwards. There was this rush of behavioral change that people thought was really going to sort of change the cultural conversation. And yet now here we are in, you know, 2017 with a lot of sort of similar problems. When you look at the moment now, does it feel different than what was happening after Anita Hill?
Well, I think social media makes it a lot different. You know, Anita Hill required one woman to take all of the heat and all of the focus, and it really was about this one case. And one of the things that social media and the internet in general is helping us to see is patterns, right? That this is not one bad apple who can be excised, you know, like a cancer. You mm-hmm. know, like you get rid of Harvey Weinstein and the problem is solved. Yeah. Hopefully by now, at this point in the news cycle, people are not under that illusion anymore. But I really, like, I think Anita Hill was super important. And I think that expecting that one cultural moment to have solved this deeply rooted problem by itself is unrealistic, right? I think social change is really kind of glacial. Mm-hmm. And that I think of it in terms of steps forward and sometimes steps back. And I think that the rise of the faux empowerment narrative actually has been a little bit like a half step back, because I think a lot of women in the modern and the more modern era like to think of themselves as powerful and like, I'm good, and like sex is, we're all cool about sex. And so if somebody at work is making me feel uncomfortable around this, it must be on me. I need to just like toughen up, or I need to be cool or down with this. And it creates this isolation where it's on that individual woman to kind of deal with it instead of saying, hey, this isn't acceptable and you're a jerk, right? Mm-hmm. And actually that's illegal, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think Anita Hill was a great step forward, and we've done some backsliding since then. And I think I'm hopeful that this moment will be another good
Do
step
Do you feel
forward.
Like it's different in ways? I mean, beyond the social media, right? Just the conversation that we're having.
Again, I feel like it's a deeper conversation. It's becoming more of a systems conversation and not just about this one case. Mm-hmm. And I think that's materially different.
Jacqueline, I want to ask you about something that is rather personal, but you talk about it as well, and that's the fact that you're a survivor of sexual assault.
Mm-hmm.
It was in 1992. You were an undergrad at Wesleyan University. Can you talk to me about both what happened and how you sort of internalized that moment at the time and then subsequently?
Yeah. I was one of the managers of the wrestling team.
Okay.
Which is a whole story we probably don't have time for. And we were at an away meet, and we were doing poorly, and the coaches actually bought a bunch of alcohol, and there was a party, and one of the wrestlers followed me back to my room and assaulted me. It's a pretty standard mm-hmm. story, right? It's not that interesting a story, except unless you're me. Obviously it was terrible. But one of the...
How old were you?
I was 20.
All right.
Yeah. One of the things it did was it made me question every assumption I had ever had about my body and my sexuality. Because I had the assumption before then that I was safe, right? That I was in control of my mm-hmm. body. And clearly that wasn't inherently true. And so one of the meanings I've made out of that experience is getting to reconstruct from scratch how I think about sex and my body and autonomy. And I think that really informs the book and all of my work.
So we have a few minutes still left. So let's talk a bit about solutions.
Yeah.
Right? You mentioned that trying to describe a truly unscrewed sexual culture is like trying to prove a negative. And that's what I felt a bit, right? It was a little unclear as to what exactly is the right prescription forward. So help me out.
I mean, the right prescription forward is that women get to have infinite different sexual expressions, and none of them are weighted more highly than the other, or none of them are punished as long as we're not hurting anybody, right?
Mm-hmm.
That it's hard to imagine because we have these tiny boxes right now for women in terms of sex. Like, are you a good girl or a bad girl, right? Are you the virgin or the maiden or the crone or whatever, right? We have these archetypes, but what a truly unscrewed culture would look like is we would assume that women are fully human, three-dimensional people, and that our sex lives are as varied and unique to us as our fingerprints, mm-hmm. and we would judge them just as much as we judge each other's fingerprints.
And we get there by?
We get there by everybody picking a thing, right?
Okay.
So whether that means you talk to your school board about how sex ed is being taught in your school, whether that means you take an interest in what the kids in your life are learning about gender, especially mm-hmm. the boys, right?
Yeah, and I was going to ask you about that. I mean, right, so any movement, you think about, you know, the civil rights movement, whatever it was, any
yeah.
movement requires allies. And in this case, it, you know, and you talk a bit about this too, changing the definitions of masculinity, because it's hard to do that if you don't have a lot of male allies.
Yeah. I mean, on some basic practical level, I wish we didn't need men for this project, right? I feel like we would be there already, but we clearly do, right? And so we need men who are in male-only spaces, whether they're parenting boys or hanging out with their friends in the proverbial locker room,
uh-huh.
right, to say, that's not cool when this stuff comes up, when nobody's around and everybody else is assuming it's okay.
And what about, though, for some folks, if it is okay? I mean, I understand what you're saying, right? From your perspective, it's not okay, and you want to create a system where everybody is not judged. But for other folks, and I mentioned this, okay, so let's step back for a second.
Yeah.
I was a political reporter. I
yeah.
spent a lot of time asking voters what they thought about our current president's sexual allegations and behavior, right,
mm-hmm.
during the stories that came out. And I remember distinctly meeting a woman in Ohio who told me after the Access Hollywood tapes came out, well, I raised four boys. That's just locker room talk. Boys will be boys. And in her mind, there was absolutely nothing wrong with this. And she said, this is how my boys talk. And I raised four boys.
Yeah. I mean, what I would say to her is, this is how your boys talk because no one has ever expected differently of them, right? That we really can expect differently from boys and men. We really can. That they've gotten away with it this for so long because they've not been held to higher standards. And we can change that if we decide to.
Do you think it's possible?
Oh, 100% it's possible.
Do you think that we're Okay, if your utopia is like a 10, where are we right now?
Where did we start? What's one?
Okay, let's say the 1960s, before the 1960s
so
revolution.
So 1950s.
Sure, 1950s.
Like Mad Men, right.
Yeah, Mad Men era. If that was a starting point, where are we now?
I think we're like at a 3 or 4.
Oh, wow. So you think there's a ways to go?
I think there is absolutely a ways to go.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Jacqueline.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
That's Jacqueline Friedman. Her new book is called Unscrewed: Women, Sex, Power, and How to Stop Letting the System Screw Us All. She'll be speaking at the Cambridge Public Library tonight in a talk presented by Harvard Bookstore. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Asma Khalid. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Asma Khalid. I'm going to go out on a limb now and guess that food is on your mind this week. I'm also going to say it's probably a lot of classic New England food. You know, think cranberries or turkey. At Yankee Magazine, New England food is always on the mind. And the latest issue features winners of the magazine's 5th annual Editor's Choice Food Awards. Amy Traverso is senior food editor at Yankee Magazine and author of the award-winning The Apple Lover's Cookbook. Welcome, Amy.
Thanks so much for having me.
And you can probably hear things are getting opened up around here.
I bring the party.
If you can't see, because you probably can't see what Amy has brought for us, there's like an assortment of cheeses and chocolates, and she was actually just sort of like scraping away the cheese for me right before we went on there. So thank you, Amy. But before we dive into anything, I'm reading that the Editor's Choice Award is a celebration of New England's best cheeses, meats, jams, sweets, and other gift-worthy treats. Of course, we'll also link to the Yankee Magazine article at radioboston.org. But talk about a couple of the winners that you're most excited about.
Gosh, it's like choosing among your babies. You know, I become so attached to these products because I know how much work goes into them.
But you
them.
Know there's always
and
a
they're
favorite,
so good.
You know.
Well, I'm going to say a couple of them have particularly good stories.
Okay. So
there's a cheese in front of you, Europa
one?
From Arethusa Farm. The one, yep, it's
Ooh.
On that slicer.
Should I taste it or
yes,
should I wait?
Please,
no, let me wait a little
okay.
bit. Have some a little bit of patience.
Okay, so this is an Alpine style cheese, and it comes from I think one of the most interesting cheese operations in New England. It's owned by two senior executives from Manolo Blahnik, the luxury shoe company.
Oh wow!
So they had a weekend retreat.
They're not from here though, are they? They're
based in New York.
Okay,
but
okay.
they had a weekend retreat in Litchfield County, and the property across the street went up for sale. And they were concerned it was going to go under development as either condominiums or a golf course. So they purchased it and realized that it had this long heritage as a farm operation. They said, well, why don't we go back to that? So they invested more millions of dollars building
wow.
this incredible operation. They have hundreds of cows. They have beautiful facilities. They have a restaurant. I mean, this is like a destination cheese making operation. They do ice cream.
What's it called?
It's called Arethusa Farm.
Arethusa Farm.
And it's in Litchfield, and you can get all kinds of cheeses, ice cream, yogurt, fresh milk, and they are keeping land agricultural, which is really important. And a lot of these products have these sort of larger missions beyond just making delicious stuff for us
mm-hmm.
to eat. You know, they're keeping green land green or green space green. They're offering farmers a way to make a sustainable living beyond just, say, you know, producing commodity milk, which can't
yeah.
really support a family anymore.
Wow. Plus, I also just love that it's by two execs from Manolo Blahnik.
I know.
Like it's like luxury cheese.
They're not like making the cheese every day, but they're very involved, they're, and this was a real passion
oh,
project.
Wow. So can I try it or
yes,
should
please.
I wait?
Yes,
okay.
So that's sort
right.
of Alpine style. When this I say Alpine style,
okay.
I'm talking like think of Gruyere or
okay.
Swiss cheese. It's kind of nutty, a little bit sweet. Just a really, it's great for like a grilled cheese.
It is
cheese,
nice. Yeah,
it
feels like it'd be very good on a sandwich.
Yes, sandwich. Mm. Grilled cheese, like, or in fondue.
You
really
make
a really
yeah.
good fondue.
It's very rich.
Yes,
and
it
flavorful.
Is.
I feel,
yes.
Yeah, yeah.
They do Holsteins, Brown Swiss, and one other type of cow that they, Brown Swiss, Holsteins, and dairy cow. Another type of dairy cow. And they combine the milks, but all of the milk that goes into the cheese is from their farm. So this is a farmstead
okay.
cheese.
Okay.
This is, yeah.
All right.
So then another one that I like, which is a fun story, is Vicuña Chocolate. Vicuña Chocolate.
Is this the chocolate bar in front of me?
This is the
okay.
chocolate bar. So this is a chocolate bar that's sourced. It's called a bean-to-bar chocolate, which
right.
means everything that goes into every part of the process from the beans to the bar is done in-house. A lot of chocolatiers buy chocolate, and they do really delicious stuff to it. Mm-hmm. To make chocolate from beans requires a lot of skill and equipment. And so this was started by a young woman named Neely Cohen, who was a pastry chef. She won a competition, the Food Network Sweet Genius Award, and she opened up this chocolate shop in Peterborough, New Hampshire.
Interesting.
A tiny town.
Yeah.
She decided, after multiple years, she decided to do something else, and she sold the business to Nate Morrison and Casey Goodrich. They're two recent high school graduates.
These guys
are really young. And with their families, they took over this business. They studied under her. They learned her methods, and they're continuing her mission. So this bar is from Bolivia. It has, and please break off a little
piece.
It's got really wonderful notes.
Who knows me knows that I literally keep chocolate in my desk. So it has been.
So all these beans are sourced from Bolivia. I like it because it has sort of a chocolatey, fruity profile. They say there's like a black truffle.
It's actually really good.
Flavor.
Yeah.
Isn't it really good?
It's really good.
And it's really beautiful.
And I love dark
texture.
Chocolate.
And it's 70%.
I actually keep this. Like, oh, this is amazing.
Yeah, really, really good. And then let's see. Oh, there's so many good ones. Well, let's drink something.
Okay.
So this is a non-alcoholic sparkling cider. Now, many of us grew up at the kids' table, right, at Thanksgiving, and we would get the sparkling apple juice, which was really syrupy and came in a big jug and wasn't particularly interesting to drink. This is made by...
Right, let me just lean over
a bit. I'm going to pass this to you.
Yeah.
Okay.
So you're going to have to hold on to it. No worries. Okay. I can hold on to it.
So this... This is made by a couple. I love this. It's so New England. This is a couple. She was Kate and Charles Dodge. She was a lawyer. He was a Dartmouth professor. They decided to retire by starting a business as entrepreneurs. And I'm going to just pour this. Maybe the listeners can hear. So basically, Charles got interested in beer making. And it occurred to him as he was learning how to make beer that there were all these apple orchards all around them. Why don't they use the fruit? So now they make fruit wines. They make liqueurs. But they also make this non-alcoholic bubbly. And I think it just tastes so much
better. And where are they based?
Better.
In New Hampshire?
In Putney, Vermont.
In Putney, Vermont. Okay, I'm going to try this bit.
I mean, it's sweet.
It's lots of bubbles.
It's lots of bubbles.
Which is normally often not the case in sparkling drinks. I feel like sparkling drinks, they tend to... Well, we also just opened it, I guess.
Yeah. No, but it's really got a nice effervescence. And it tastes... It has like a little bit more of the full apple sort of...
It tastes more like an apple.
Spectrum of flavor.
Yes. Yeah.
It's got more like bite
Real.
To it.
Yeah.
It's not just syrupy sweet. It's
really
nice.
Really nice.
So whether you... Honestly, it's just a nice aperitif, even if you drink alcohol. Like, you can drink it plain. You can put a shot of bourbon in it.
So can you purchase these at a local place around here?
Yes.
I'm just thinking I have a niece and nephew coming for Thanksgiving.
Many of these, yes. So this is... you can go on their website, and all their websites are listed on your website.
Mm-hmm.
Use this putneywine.com, but you can find out where they're sold. I've seen a lot of the products that we choose at local markets like Formaggio Kitchen. Italy has a ton of local products. There's a lot of great cheese shops all over the Boston area that carry these. And and the market for all of them is growing, and there's more and more of these makers kind of coming online.
I'm so impressed by the different stories behind the makers too, right? Especially the chocolate.
Yeah.
Just the sheer fact that these are like two high school grads, 17-year-old
kids buying a chocolate
their
company.
Own,
And they're good. I mean, this isn't
this
like...
I'm actually going to have another piece.
Yeah, it's really good stuff. It's legitimately solidly good.
It is solid chocolate. So are there any more? I see a couple cheeses here.
So then we also have... this is Mountain Ash, that one that looks sort of... white with like a nice soft bloomy rind. That's from Sweet Rowan Farm in far northern Vermont. I mean, this is like God's country, Vermont.
Like near Canada.
West Glover. Yeah, Ohio. Near Canada. Gorgeous, gorgeous landscape. And this is also a farmstead cheese. Everything's coming from the farm. Paul Lasai is the farmer. They're raising the cattle. Blair Johnson is the cheesemaker. This is kind of a bloomy rind, so
Sorry, that's me still drinking in the background.
You can't put it down because you don't have a vase. It's a terrific, like really creamy. I first encountered it at the Vermont Cheesemakers Festival, and it just blew me away. The other one is a gorgeous goat cheese from Kennebec Cheesery in Maine.
I'm going to try a bit of these, too.
Yeah, really wonderful.
I'll swivel my little plate around.
That's a really gorgeous, just really creamy. Like, if you're somebody who doesn't like...
It's good for crackers.
Really good for crackers.
Yeah? Okay.
And if you don't like goat cheese... Some people think that they don't like goat cheese. This is such a mild, creamy goat cheese. If you're sort of put off by what can sometimes seem like funky flavors, Jean Coons is the cheesemaker. She's from New Zealand. She knows her stuff, and this is just a great cheese.
And then,
and what's on the outside? Like thyme?
So, oh, that's an herbs de Provence.
Herbes de Provence.
Mix.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
Now, if you're in the mood for one bite of something sweet, I have one more treat for you. Do we have time?
Okay, we have a little bit of time, maybe like 30 seconds.
This is for the gluten-free eaters out there. This is an amazing gluten-free almond cake from Mayfair Farm, also in New Hampshire. It's made with almonds.
All right.
And butter and eggs, all sourced locally.
Oh, wow.
And this is just fantastic. And even if you do eat gluten, you will just love this cake.
All right, I'll try it by real quick. Thank you. It's gluten-free.
And it's gluten-free. Oh, wow. And so it's a great solution for you've got some sort of celiac
sensitive
folks.
I'm always a little skeptical, I'll be honest, I'm gluten-free.
Yeah, no, it's good though, right?
But it's great. Well, thank you so much. Amy, this has been an absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
That's Amy Traverso. She's senior food editor at Yankee Magazine. I'm sorry, I'm like chewing still. And she's author of the award-winning The Apple Lover's Cookbook. That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Asma Khalid. This is Radio Boston.